I don't know if you saw the story or not that's been floating around the internet. I saw it on Facebook. Kim, actually, I saw her version of it. But there's a story that has different versions of it, but it's a powerful one, I think. There's a granddaughter who shares her current struggles with her grandmother. And she starts laying out all these desert things that are happening in her life, all these adversities. And the grandma listens intently to what her granddaughter has to say. But she quietly gets up and starts to put on the stove. And she warms up three pots of water and gets them boiling. And then doesn't tell her granddaughter exactly what she's going to do. She just gets the pots boiling and leaves it there. But then she sets in some carrots, and she puts carrots in one pot, and she sets eggs in the other, and raw eggs in the other. And in the third, she puts some coffee grounds, and she leaves all this stuff. And her granddaughter is kind of wondering what grandma's up to, but they continue their conversation, and she continues to share her struggles, and her grandmother gives her a listening ear and the support that she needs. But after the end of about 20 minutes, when everything had been boiled and was done, she brings out this plate and she lays it in front of her granddaughter and she asks, "Now tell me, what do you see?" Now, her granddaughter's wondering exactly what's going on here. I mean, she sees carrots, eggs, and coffee, and she tells her grandmother that. But the grandmother says, "Now I want you to look at this a little bit closer. Tell me what you see in the carrots. What are they like? What do they look?" Well, she said, "They're mushy and they're soft." "Okay." She said, "Adversity is kind of like that. Sometimes we can go in thinking that we're hard and strong like a raw carrot, but the adversity can really break us down and make us mushy." She said, "What about the egg? What do you see there?" Well, she peeled out the shell and sure enough, inside was a hard-boiled egg. She said, "So what do you see here?" "Well, the egg started off soft, and as it faced the adversity of the boiling water, it got hard." And her grandmother says, "The same thing can happen to your heart when you face desert experiences. You can stay soft and malleable. You can be open to the Lord's leading, but sometimes the adversity can cause bitterness and envy and anger to harden it to where it's impenetrable. But then there's the coffee. The coffee grounds started as coffee grounds. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't eat coffee beans, right? I mean, it's not something I chew and chomp away, but when put with water, the coffee beans are transformed into something that's delectable and delicious. It has a purpose." And the grandmother says, "The same thing can happen to you through your adversity. The adversity can transform you and make you moldable and make you more of what God has called you to be. It can shape us." The reality is, adversity and desert experiences have that kind of a power in our lives. And sometimes we can think that we're destined to be a carrot, that our strength that we have is going to be sapped away and we're going to be mush at the end. Sometimes the bitterness and anger can overtake us and we can become hard-hearted. But as we saw last week, the goal of God using adversity, His purpose for adversity and desert experiences in our life is that He can use it to shape us and mold us into becoming more of the person that He wants us to be. So we're in the middle of the desert. That's where we're at in the book of Exodus. At Crossway Church, we just preached through a book, and we've been through some pretty dramatic stuff. We've seen that the people were slaves in Egypt, but God sent Moses to save them. And then God does all these supernatural things. He saves them through 10 plagues and the parting of the Red Sea, and they get their ultimate source of salvation. And they have this mountaintop experience. But God doesn't leave them there, because the mountaintop experience at the edge of the Red Sea is not their final home. Their final home is the Promised Land. And so He moves them from the mountaintop experience into the desert. And we're going to see that they're in this desert for a while. And as we've said, the book of Exodus isn't just a bunch of historical stories. Yes, it is. It is historical stories that happen. But the book of Exodus also gives us insight into how God works into our own lives. It gives us insight into how we respond to different circumstances. And what we're going to see here today is that Israel responds, again, in a negative way to their desert experience. And from it, I think we can learn some pretty important lessons another insight into what God can, how God can use suffering to not just use it to crumble us or to give us hard hearts, but rather to transform us. So if you want to turn with me to Exodus 16, we're going to read page 50. It's on page 50, I believe, in your Bibles, but we're just going to read through the whole thing, and we're going to read through it there. So Exodus 16, it's actually 1 through 36, the whole chapter, but it starts on page 50. The whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt. And in the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out of this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." Then the Lord said to Moses, "I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to gather out each day and to go out each day and gather enough for that day. In this way, I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions or on the sixth day if they are to prepare what they bring in, and that is twice as much as they gather on the other days." So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, "In the evening you will know that it was the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, and in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we that we should grumble against him?" Moses also said, "You will know that it was the Lord when he gives you meat to eat in the evening and all the bread you want in the morning, because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we? You are not grumbling against us, but against the Lord." And then Moses told Aaron, "Say to the entire Israelite community, 'Come before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling.'" While Aaron was speaking to the whole Israelite community, they looked toward the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God." That evening, quail came and covered the camp. And in the morning, there was a layer of dew around the camp. And when the dew was gone, the flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, "What is this?" For they did not know what it was. Moses said to it, "It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Each one is to gather as much as he needs. Take an omer for each person you have in your tent." The Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much, some little. And when they measured it by the omer, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered the little did not have too little. Each one gathered as much as he needed. And then Moses said to them, "No one is to keep any of it until morning." However, some of them had paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots and began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. Each morning, everyone gathered as much as he needed, and when the sun grew hot, it melted away. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much, two omers for each person, and the leaders of the community came and reported this to Moses. And he said to them, "This is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow is a day of rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil. Save whatever is left and keep it until morning." And so they saved it until morning. And as the Lord commanded, it did not stink or get maggots in it. "Eat it today," Moses said, "because today is the Sabbath to the Lord, and you will not find any of it on the ground today. 6 days you are to gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be not any." Nonetheless, some of the people went out to the seventh day to gather it, but they found none. And then the Lord said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions? Bear in mind that the Lord has given you Sabbath, and this is why on the sixth day he gives you bread for 2 days. Everyone is to stay where he is on the seventh day. No one is to go out." So the people rested on the seventh day. The people of Israel called the bread manna. It was white like coriander seed and tasted like wafers made with honey. And Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Take an omer of the manna and keep it for generations to come, so that they can see the bread I gave you to eat in the desert when I brought you out of Egypt." So Moses said to Aaron, "Take a jar and put an omer of manna in it, then place it before the Lord to keep for the generations to come." And as the Lord commanded Moses, Aaron put the manna in front of the testimony that it might be kept. And the Israel ate manna 40 years until they came to the land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. An omer is 1/10 of an epheth. As we started out last week, we need to begin with a concrete foundation and the way that the story begins. And the way that the story begins is sometimes with a little bit of a difficult, hard truth sometimes for us to understand. But the reality is that the Bible teaches us that oftentimes the Lord leads us into deserts. And in this case, He led Israel into another desert. It says that the whole community set out from Elim to the desert of Sin. And what's implied here, even though it's not stated as in last week, that God is continually to leading them by the cloud. There's an itinerary here. This didn't happen by happen chance. They didn't get lost in the desert because their GPS wasn't working. Rather, God was actually leading them and guiding them along the way. And what we notice is at the end of the last chapter, the people were hanging out in Elim. God had led them there, and it was a comfortable place. It was a place that was very comfortable for them, but it had water and it had shade. And yet, God led them from that comfortable place to another desert experience. The reason is because Elim wasn't their final destination. Their final destination was Canaan, the promised land. It's mentioned here in the text. And so God needed to guide them through this place. He needed to guide them in a new direction. Even though it was uncomfortable, even though they left this place of comfort and ease and even nice, having life be everything they wanted it to be, God needed to move them into another desert experience. And what we remind that, the lesson that we can learn is that God guides us from comfortable places to desert experiences as well. You know, we don't like to think about that. We don't always often enjoy the desert experiences, but you and I are not in our final destination point here either. We live in the midst of a wilderness. There's sin and brokenness around us. And oftentimes God will move us, not oftentimes, throughout our life, God will move us from places of comfort to desert experiences too. Last week we said that our desert experiences can be a variety of things. Our desert experiences can be a loneliness or relational turmoil. It can be financial unrest or having hope that a certain dream may occur and to have it passed. There's so many different desert experiences we can have, but they're things that often cause us to question God's goodness for us, and it causes pain and suffering. That's what a desert experience is. It's a difficult place to live, and we all face these times of suffering. But the truth that we see here is that God is the one who is leading our life. He is the one who is guiding us. And sometimes He takes us to this difficult place. But He does it not to crush us or to make our hearts hard. Rather, as we use in the opening illustration, He does it because He wants to transform us. He wants us to become more the people that He's called us to be. And it's nothing like a desert that causes growth in us. And the reason why desert causes growth in us is because really what the desert does is it shows us what's deep inside of our hearts. Last week, we used that analogy of a dried lake bed that's happening in California, where they're literally water levels are 100 feet lower than what they used to be. And so what they're uncovering is all these things that remained hidden, cars, planes, boats, gold mines, everything. But the reality is that those things were not seen when the water was plentiful. And just like that in our own lives, when life is going well, when we're getting everything that we expect or that we desire, we're unaware of the desires that are at work underneath the surface of our heart. And we can be unaware of the things that are literally guiding us and directing us because there's plenty. But in the desert experiences where everything we have seems to be sometimes taken away or where they're threatened, we see those things come above the surface and we can begin to do that. And the reason why God gives us desert experiences is because we desperately need that insight into our own hearts. Because we desperately need to see what's truly going on inside of our hearts so that we can understand the sin and the brokenness that's there. That's how God uses desert experiences. I know they're brutal, but yet I can tell you that the black nights of my soul, and I mean those dark times where I questioned everything, are the times where I had the ultimate and the most growth. It wasn't fun. It wasn't pretty. It was full of questioning and doubt. But yet, God uses those experiences to reveal the things in our hearts that cause us, that we trust in, even beyond God. And in this story in particular, we see that God uses this desert experience to reveal our lack of trust in His provision. It says it right there in the beginning that Israel cried out to God and grumbled against them. Now, I don't know about you, but it says that this is going to be a trust, and it's going to be a test. Now, when we think of a test, we may think of a pass and fail type thing as far as school goes, but really what suffering tests are, as God says here in this passage, that it's a test for His people, are more like the test that I did when I was a lifeguard on water. It was every 2 hours I had to go, and I had to do this pH test because the water looked fine, but the pH or the chlorine could be completely off. And if it got too far off, it could have disastrous consequences. And so it was this ongoing testing to show what was the truly going on in our hearts. And that's the kind of test that this was. It was a continual test to see if the people of Israel would actually put their trust in God. And desert experiences can do that for us. They can provide us with that same challenge, and it can reveal the same thing, that we actually often lack the trust of God's provision. See, Israel didn't trust God's provision. Now, this may not seem like it. I mean, it seems like to me, when I first read this passage, I got to admit, this is a really passage that I'm pretty familiar with. It's one that I could probably rattle off the story to my girls. I've read it in their Bibles over and over. It's a familiar passage. But when I originally read this story and I read how big of a complaint the Israelites make, I mean, they make this huge hyperbole. They say, it would be better for us to go hang out in Egypt and to die there than to live here in the desert. I think, man, they must be hungry. They must be desperate. Because I read the first part of Exodus. I read that they went through genocide where Pharaoh killed their babies. I read that Pharaoh oppressed them and literally made them cry out to God for salvation. And so if they're crying out and grumbling to God, begging for food and saying that Egypt would be better, then their situation must be pretty desperate. But it's not actually the case if you look at the story. What's actually happening is what one of my favorite artists who wrote a song called Painting Pictures of Egypt, her name is Sarah Groves, says that they're painting pictures of Egypt but forgetting what it lacked. They're idealizing what it is, and the reason why they're doing that is because their complaint wasn't actually based on an outward thing whatsoever. See, we think it is. We think that they lacked food and that they were hungry, that that's the reason why they whined and complained. But if you look just 3 verses down and you look at other places in the Bible, it makes it clear that their complaint wasn't about the quantity of food, it was about the quality of food. Israel's grumbling was actually caused by an inner discontentment towards the food that God gave them. Exodus 17 says that they had livestock. I don't know about you, but if I'm starving and I think I'm going to go back to Egypt and that's better than to live where I'm at, if I got a cow or a sheep or a goat, I'm going to kill it and eat it, right? That's what I'm going to do. But the reality, they had some food. They had resources that they could. They just weren't satisfied with it. They weren't satisfied with the provision that God gave them. And if that's not proof enough, look, Psalm 18, verses 17 and 18 and 30 all highlight that what they demanded was because they wanted some of the food that they craved. Not that they didn't have food, but rather they craved other kinds of food. So Israel's complaint, their grumbling in the desert, wasn't necessarily just because of a lack of provision from God, that outward circumstances that they pinned it on, but rather, it was caused by an inner discontentment towards the food God gave them. Now, here's the thing. It's easy for me to go, you silly Israelites. I mean, get this thing figured out. You've seen God do all these crazy things. I mean, things that I would just dream of seeing God do. These miracles and supernatural things. And God provides you with food, but you're not content. Like, get your life together. But then I look at myself in the mirror. and I examine my own life, and I realize that I'm a little bit more of a whiner than I would care to admit. I don't always whine externally, but I whine internally. And a lot of times my whining, too, its root isn't outward experiences. It's inward discontentment that causes it. Our grumbling is caused by inner discontentment rather than outward circumstances. And at its root, we too often don't trust God's provision for our life. I mean, just think about the things that you've grumbled about lately. We can say that we can fill in the blank with the blank whenever. We can say our lives would be better if we had blank, a new cell phone, a better relationship, if our spouse didn't act this way, or our parents didn't treat us like this, or if our kids behaved, or if we had a better job, or a better car. I mean, or if we had a relationship because we want to be in a relationship and we're single, or if we want to have a kid and we don't have one and it's hard and it's painful, but we can fill in this blank that our lives will be happier if we only get this, and we can grumble because of that. But really what this is at the heart is a lack of trust that God has provided us with everything we need, that He will get us through this difficult circumstance, and that He can guide us through this desert. And that our life might be different than what we expected, but that doesn't mean that God is far away, and that He hasn't given us more provisions than what we think. There's a quote, a guy named Dan Kistler said, "The person with the discontented heart has the attitude that everything he does for God is too much, and everything God does for him is too little." And isn't that easy for us to get into that kind of a mentality? And isn't that a little bit of what our grumbling is actually based on usually? Maybe I'm the only one who struggles with this. But the reality is a lot of times my grumbling isn't based on what I really need, but rather what I want. And when I think that I know more of what I want than what I need, then really what I'm doing is not trusting that God has provided everything we need. When we grumble about our spouse, we're really doubting that the person God gave us, provided for us, is enough. When we grumble about our kids or parents or siblings, we doubt that God has placed us in the right family. When we doubt that God would equip us to deal with difficult circumstances at work, we doubt that God will give us the wisdom we need. And when we grumble about the lack of resources, needing a better car or a home or a new device or whatever the case may be, we're often doubting that God has provided us with enough good things to live. And I'm not saying that we don't often have legitimate needs. And there are times when we desperately need to cry out to God and say, "God, I need this for sustenance and for life." But I dare bet that if we look at the majority of our suffering, and our grumbling, and our complaints. That word happens like 10 times in this chapter, how they're grumbling, grumbling, whining, whining, whining. It's like my kids this morning who were whining me to death and driving me nuts. It was like an illustration of this text, right? But our whining and our grumbling is often centered not on an attitude of graciousness and recognizing that God has provided us with more than we could ever imagine, but rather a lack of trust that God needed. So I have some questions there on your sermon sheet that I want you to ponder this week. What have you grumbled about lately, and what is the true source of this grumbling? Is it really the outward circumstances, or is there an inner discontentment at work in our lives? Something that we feel like we need, that we desire, and there's really a lack of trust. But as I said, God doesn't give us desert experiences just to mess with us. He's not a fickle God who says, "Hey, you know, I'm kind of bored today. Let's see if I can mess with Brad's life today. That'd be kind of entertaining." You know, He's not fickle like that. God has a purpose for our suffering. He's got a plan. And what we see in this passage is that God uses desert experiences to help us trust in His provisions more. See, desert experiences really challenge us whether or not we believe this verse, that we know that in all things God works for good of those who love Him, who have been called according to His purpose. not just good things and blessings, but including the difficult things. And it causes us to it's a test to doubt, to wondering whether or not we're going to humble ourselves and admit that we don't have life figured out as much as we think. And we're going to trust that there's a God who is in control, who has a bigger plan and a better plan for our lives. Not always more blessings financially, but more character and better relationships because we have to go through these difficult circumstances. Deuteronomy 8, verses 2 through 3 highlights that. He says, He humbled you, causing you to hunger and then feeding you manna. And it says that you learn that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. There's a lesson that these people needed to learn, that the Israel did. And what we see throughout this passage is that God perfectly met Israel's needs, not their initial wants. The Bible doesn't tell us what kind of food the Israelites wanted. It doesn't tell us why they grumbled and what their stomachs were craving. But what the Bible does tell us is that God heard their grumblings and their whinings. And rather than giving them what they wanted, He gave them what they needed. And so He gives them manna. And He creates this system. I mean, if you think about it, this passage, I read it and I was like, man, God is just going on and on about the system. Like, isn't once enough? I mean, but He repeats it one or two times. This is what's going to happen. You're going to get bread, and it's only good for a day, except for on the sixth day, the Sabbath day, it's good for two. And that story is repeated over and over, but I think that there's some lessons that we need to learn from here. And the first one is this. God makes it absolutely clear that He is the provider of the manna. He's the provider of their food. He does it in dramatic fashion where the cloud appears when Moses tells us this, and He provides it in a dramatic way. This is not some natural phenomenon that happened in the desert. This was a daily provision from the Lord. He provided them the manna. But the Israelites had to gather their own food. I mean, they couldn't just say, hey, we're just going to sit here and do nothing. No, they were required to go out and work. And this is how we see God's sovereignty and His wills at work. He's the provider. He's the ultimate one who's at work. But it doesn't give human beings this lack of responsibility. We have to do our part, and that's why we're held responsible too. We see it right here. God's the provider. He's the initiator. It's His will that's the prime mover in this situation, but yet the people have to go out and do that. And they don't have to just take care of themselves. You look at there's an individual and a communal aspect. They got to go get their own needs, but they also have to take care of the people in their tents. But there's an even important lesson here, I think. God used this setup this way to use repetition to teach the Israelites to learn to trust His provision. See, God could have just dropped a big, huge herd of camels or goats or sheep. He could have done something like that to provide them what He needed, and they could have felt the sense of comfort and sustenance that He had taken care of their needs. But what He did is He created a daily rhythm and a weekly rhythm that required them each night to go to bed wondering if God would actually provide the manna again. And then on the Sabbath day, the sixth day, when the manna would actually rot if they kept it for longer than a day, they had to trust that the manna that they kept would actually last 2 days, different than the way that it acted. So they knew that God was the provider and that they had to trust Him each and every day, each and every week. Every good parent knows that their kid needs to, if they want to learn something, they got to use the power of repetition. It's why my girls are hearing this over and over again. You need to obey Dad cheerfully, completely, and quickly. Quickly, cheerfully, and completely. And they hear that really nice when they do it well. Thanks for obeying Daddy cheerfully, quickly, and completely. And when they don't, it's like, what did Daddy say? What's the rule? We need to obey what? Cheerfully, quickly. Right, that's what I use that. Everybody who's ever learned an instrument knows that the only way that you can actually learn an instrument is by repetition. Practice, practice, practice. Same with sports or whatever the case may be. If you want to learn a language, it takes repetition to master a task. And so God set this circumstance, this provision in a way that it used that repetition. And every day they had to practice trusting in God. And God used it to help them to learn to trust Him more and to trust that His provision is actually what they needed. But we see something else. We see that God is patient with Israel's failure and their lack of trust. I got to admit that oftentimes I'm not very patient with my kids. When that whiny tone hits on, it's like you aren't going to get whatever you want because like I just can't handle the tone, right? It drives me nuts. But we don't just see that the people of Israel were whiny. We see that they absolutely disobeyed God, not once, but twice. They went and got bread and tried to save it over a day when He said it would only last one day in the first 6 days. And then when they were told not to go out on the seventh day, they went out anyway, and there wasn't anything there. And yet, God doesn't say, I'm done with you. The whining, and now you disobey me, I'm done. You're through. I'm done providing for you. No. He's patient. He's constantly providing and giving them the grace and the mercy and the sustenance that they don't deserve. And what we see here is a link, a glimpse of the compassion of God. What this tells us is that God, what this story reminds us as well, is that God perfectly meets our needs, even if it's different than what we initially think or what we want initially. You see, you and I can make the same mistake. We can think we know what we deserve or what we need, but God is the sovereign God of the universe who knows us even better than we know ourselves. And in our times of suffering, He's trying to teach us to trust His provision. And what we see, the thing that we doubt oftentimes in our times of suffering, is that God's got our best interest in mind. And this story reminds us that God perfectly meets our needs, even if it's different than what we want initially. The ultimate need that God has provided for us is Jesus. He is the only manna that can fill our spiritual hunger. I said it last week that oftentimes God uses difficult circumstances to create a thirst for Him, and the same is true for us. Oftentimes when life is hard, that's the times when we search after God. That's the time when we cry out to Him, where we hunger for it. And oftentimes our hunger for Him is cloaked in other things, but ultimately there is this sense that there's something missing in our lives that's incomplete. And it's interesting that Jesus Himself actually uses this story after He feeds 5,000. And what He says to the people is that what Moses gave you isn't really the ultimate bread of God. The bread of life is Me. I am the only thing that can satisfy your spiritual hunger. He ties that experience, that lesson of trusting provision of God, to Himself, and He says, what you ultimately need is not physical bread, but you need the bread of life, the sacrifice that I'm going to make to offer you the atonement for your sins, because you can't live the perfect life, and I'm going to. And so the only thing that can ultimately fulfill your life is Jesus Christ and the manna that He gives us, the daily dispense of grace that comes when we put our hope and trust in Him and when we fail over and over again. But God is gracious and He does it. But we need to put our hope and trust in Him as our Savior. We can't just say, oh, that's nice. We need to do that. But it's not just about providing for our spiritual needs. God also provides for our daily needs. And the desert experiences prove that to us over and over again. It reminds us that, yes, we have this list of wants, and you know, it's not bad to desire other things, but when that desire creates discontentment and when it becomes stronger than the things that really matter, then we got to be careful about the role that these good things have played in our lives. And often desert experiences prove to us that we can have a meaningful life even without the things we thought we couldn't live without. When we face chronic pain and each day is painful and sorrowful, it's hard. There's days where we want to throw in the towel and give up. And when we see our loved ones do that, it breaks us. But we also see that God can often provide us just enough strength to get through each day. When we are in desperate financial needs and we have all these wants of things that we want, God reminds us that He provides us way more than we could ever imagine. Sometimes we need that reminder that we don't need a bigger house or a new car or that God's already provided us with good things. And that sometimes we need to trust that His provision is enough. It's not an easy pill to swallow, but it's the desert experiences that help us see the good gifts that God has provided around us. And it's those times that God uses to show His provision for our need. It's what helps us trust Him more. Every time He takes care of our needs or spares us from danger, every time He enables us to repent of our sins or believe in His promise, every time He works things out in a way that seemed impossible, we see a little bit more of God's glory and we begin to trust Him more. I got to tell you, this is the life of this church. I've seen this. When we started, you know, God, we saw God at work, and I've seen God at work in every circumstance and every year. It seems like every time where we wonder, God, how is this going to happen? How are we going to have somebody fill this role? Or how are we going to get this? God provides somebody and drops it in. And it's like I've learned on my good days to be patient, to wait, and trust. Hey, there's a need. Don't freak out. Don't worry. Trust my provision. It's not easy, but life is so much better than that way. And that's really the challenge of the desert. It challenges us to trust that God will provide. And if He doesn't provide it, that our life is going to be okay, even if we don't have it. The problem is, you and I don't trust and we don't worry, just like the Israelites. We may not go out and get manna, try and do that, but the reality is we can try and control things. We can doubt. We can have fear. And this story reminds us of that same truth, that God is patient with our failures and our lack of trust in Him. God is just as patient with us in our whining, in our lack of faith, in our lack of belief, of doubt and all those things as He is with the Israelites. So when we put on our whiny pants or grumpy pants, as I call them to my kids, when we throw out every complaint and out there and we can sometimes doubt whether or not God can put up with us because we're so impatient with our own kids and the people around us who whine, this story reminds us that God is just as gracious to us as He was with the Israelites. He's compassionate. He's gracious. He's slow to anger. He's abounding in love. And He doesn't treat us as our sins deserve. And we can rest in that. See, the only way we're going to get through the desert isn't by trying harder, isn't to make God love us more by doing more. It isn't by thinking that if we put more pressure on ourselves, if we can just gather, life will be better. No. It's by trusting that the ultimate provision God gave us is Jesus Christ. And our salvation is of more importance than any earthly good. But it's also by trusting that the good gifts that God has given us, that are around us, that we often take for granted, are enough. And to trust that He has provided us probably with more than we could ever imagine. So we don't have to complain about our outward circumstances. Rather, we can have contentment no matter what the circumstances reign, because we trust that there's a God who's in control of our lives and that He's leading us and guiding us even when we don't see it. That's where the source of our hope and our salvation and our peace